Hi everyone, and welcome to Team Early Childhood Podcast. It's absolutely fantastic to have you listening to us. This week, we've got Julie Ovington going to be talking to us all about her fantastic research. And just to let you into a secret, she's literally just passed it, and she is now, I'm going to call her Dr. Julie Ovington. Hi Julie.
Hi Aaron.
How are you?
I'm really, really good. I'm a little bit frustrated with lockdown, I guess, like everybody else, but making do.
Oh, well, Julie, just before we start, everybody knows that we've kind of planned some questions before the podcast.
Yeah.
And there'll be a couple of questions, but obviously everybody gets the same question at the end. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
Yes, I can. I am a childhood studies lecturer at Sunderland University. Previous to that, I was a PhD candidate at Northumbria University. And previous to that, I worked in a nursery school setting up a two-year-old provision under the guise of the rollout of free early education and care for two-year-olds. I am a mother of three. My children are 24, 23 and 6.
Very big gap there, Julie.
Huge gap.
And you've recently just submitted and passed your thesis.
Yeah, so I can really, my research has come out of having my third child, and she questioned absolutely everything that I know or knew about children. Who they were, their identities. And she stopped me one day and she asked me, did she not have her own mind?
Right.
And I really started to think about what agency is, which obviously led to the research and the formulation of my thesis, which was submitted well over a year ago.
Yeah.
And then I passed my Viva last year, but obviously due to lockdown and everything, it didn't go through until very recently.
Yeah. So the first question is, obviously you've already started talking about, you know, it's great really that, I mean, you can't get any better than the voice of the child than what you've just described. So could you tell us a bit about, obviously, the focus of your research? And you mentioned about agency. So could you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah. So when Eleanor posed that question to me, she was coming up three at the time, and it created what I would call a sensation. And it wasn't just a sensation in terms of a bodily reaction. It's something that's what I could say is lingered on. And I started to really think about, well, actually, how do we know who children are when they walk into a setting? And where is the relationship between the key worker and the child, or the child and the environment, the child and other objects, and how do these all have a relationship? So when I think about my research, it is very much about the relationships or the entanglements that we have in early education itself.
Yeah.
So that was the premise of it, was, well, actually, I know my daughter and I know who she is, but how is that then conveyed by her in a setting, especially around her age group?
Right.
And how do we then work with two-year-olds and three-year-olds to make sure that there isn't a discord between what practitioners want to work with them, or a way in which they want to work with them, and actually the needs of the child? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does, yeah.
So that was very much the focus. And what I did was I did a length and breadth scope from Scotland down to London. And I visited various nurseries that were offering the two-year-old provision.
Yeah.
To look at, actually, what does this practice look like, and who are these children? And from that, I gradually started to really focus down on particular children who created sensations for me. So if a child did something that really made me stop and notice, then there was something that was being said, and it wasn't always verbal, which again added in another layer on top of my research in terms of what constitutes as voice.
Yeah.
And how can we use the voices of either practitioners and children to really get to the heart of what is good practice.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that stands out for me there, one comment that you just made was that you went across the UK, really. You got a very, very good, rigorous sample. And I think sometimes what happens is we can become very, a lot of research, a lot of policy comes from London, really. And we sometimes don't kind of look through, you know, we have to be aware that when we're doing research, don't we? I don't know if you agree, Julie, but we need to get a proper sample because different people live differently, cultures are very different. And sometimes we can get kind of blindsided, can't we, with that? I call it the city effect, you know, the city effect.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was why it was really important to kind of visit all of these nurseries to contextualise what were the reoccurring themes in every setting.
Yeah.
And then I started to really focus down on a local level. And then I picked two particular sites close to where I live and kind of did a compare and contrast. And once I was sure that the same themes that appeared in Scotland or down at London or over in the West were appearing in these schools, that I had a real platform to dig deeper.
Yeah.
So that was what it was. So my research then really focused on, well, actually, what is the nonverbal communication that's going on? What do objects or relationships with objects afford children in terms of them telling us something that's not verbal?
Yeah.
And then how can practitioners use that to also mimic it in their practice so that we get to see their creativity and their identities as well?
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's really, really important. And it kind of highlights when we're talking about that voice of the child, and actually it's that it doesn't always have to be a verbal voice.
No.
It can be, you know, what you've just described. So obviously you've done quite a rigorous piece of research. So could you explain to us what the theoretical approach was with your research, please?
So the theoretical approach that I took is taking all of those traditional ideas and theories from Bronfenbrenner, Vygotsky, Brunner, and really, really kind of just sticking them in a blender and mixing them all up.
Yeah, yeah.
And then taking the other side of things around objects and time and space and throwing them in the pot and working with post-humanist theories and again trying to get into unraveling these knots of what all of this does for the child, because it's dead easy to see the child through one lens, and I think we can quite often get into that and we'll say, oh well, yes, well, we're going to look at this from a Bronfenbrenner model, or we're going to look at this through the eyes of Vygotsky, when in actual fact there are multifacets of identity and that plays out in different ways at different times.
Yeah.
So we need all of these layers on top of each other to then see the child in a post-human sense.
You've explained, so I mean, if you were a practitioner, for example, what do you mean by post-human sense? How what does that mean to, you know, earliest practitioners?
So it is about a discursive kind of material knot whereby objects, materials and relationships with more than human matter,
right,
have equal agency for a person. So it's about decentering the person as the centre of everything, because they're not the centre of everything. A child might be able to display their identity through the use of objects, or objects will afford them something that the centred kind of approach would not always be able to give them. And that's particularly relevant in non-verbal ways.
Right.
So yeah. They can act as a voice. They can tell us a little bit more about themselves through the material relationships that they have with more than human matter.
Right. Okay. So that kind of helps really kind of put that into perspective, you know, for our practitioners and our educators as well. So what were your main findings, Julie, from your research? So what kind of came out of it?
So what came out of it was that what I say is that children are colourful, and as part of my research I use the analogy of the trolls, the Troll movie to look at how children, if they're not given a space and time to connect with material objects and connect with more than human matter, that they become less colourful. And it's almost as if you take a black and white cartoon and transpose it into colour. It becomes very vibrant, it becomes very lively. And originally I just thought that was extended to children, when in actual fact it's not. And we need to really tap into some of these things that these children told us to see how practitioners can emulate that in practice. So it was around the queered traditional sense of transitional objects. So we would think about transitional objects as something that a child will bring from home into a setting, and it'll give them some security, it'll give them a sense of belonging. When in actual fact, children seek out those objects in our classrooms and in our environments every day.
Right.
And for one example is, for one particular child, if she wasn't comfortable with something, she would go and get a Snow White dress. And that happened every time she was challenged,
yeah,
or she wasn't confident, or she wasn't secure in her attachment with a practitioner. Other children went for jigsaws or a particular book, something. There was always something in a setting that a child developed like a transitional relationship with.
Right, so it didn't always have to be something from the home.
No,
they actually made that connection with something that was that was in their setting, for example.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
And the other thing was that objects like glitter, like glue, act as voices. So in one particular instance, a child was asked to make a Christmas card, and the practitioner wanted the Christmas card made in a particular way. And what some would say was defiance, this child decided, no, she was going to recreate her own snowflake.
Right.
And she went against the grain of everything that was modelled. And it was almost as if the glitter that she used, the colourful glitter that she used, not the white glitter,
yeah,
was acting as a voice for her to say, this is not how I want to do things.
Right.
Yet you're kind of imposing something upon me that I don't want to do, so I'm going to resist. It was almost as if you could see this power struggle,
yeah,
between the practitioner and the child. And these objects, such as the glitter, the glue, the Snow White dress, they all became voices for the children and tools.
Judy, do you think that, obviously, I mean, let's talk about this playing out within practice. So if you were an earlier teacher or earlier educator or professional, the way that you'd probably see this is through observation or,
yep,
you know, adult-led, you know, kind of activities, being with the children, being part, taking part. But from what you've just described, observation probably would be the most applicable.
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you think that practitioners could take is this an opportunity to take observation even further, to kind of really kind of see, you know, the agency with these items that they're using? Could there be a perception kind of there that we've not kind of done before? Or do you get where I'm coming from?
Yes, absolutely. And I definitely think we could take this, or we could take observations a lot deeper.
Right.
So one of my vignettes, it was how children constantly smiled the minute an iPad appeared. And children were fully aware of the observational relationship that was going on at that time. They were very acutely attuned to the purpose for which it was done.
Yeah.
And therefore they would almost socially act a different role the moment they were being observed. And that could be, again, constituted as a voice. But I think I called it in my research, turning to notice, and it's turning to notice the child,
right,
and what is constituted as a voice, or what they're telling us through material objects and relationships with more than human matter.
Yeah.
And it was something that Judith Brody would obviously call OWL, really, observing, waiting, and listening. So there are platitudes with the current observational methods and modes that we have, but I think it is about getting that deeper understanding, but letting go of agenda. Because the minute you skew out an observation with a particular agenda,
Yeah.
The children can tune into that.
Right, okay.
Well, that was what obviously came through my...
No. I mean, I think that's really interesting because obviously lots of people are starting to talk about observation and how, like, it's our perceptions, really. It's our positionality that comes through. It's our understanding of what the child does. But I think this is a really interesting time to kind of think about how we can move observation forwards. And I think what you're talking about is something that we don't do on a day-to-day within our day-to-day practice.
I was going to say, because my research was very much on school readiness and how we develop school-ready children. And that is what the current mode of observation is about. And that's the rhetoric or the assessment framework that is applied or creating a particular lens.
Yeah.
When in actual fact, we almost argue that the earliest foundation stage should be unique. It's about the individual child. When the observational methods that we employ aren't about getting to that. So I think we definitely need to let go of this agenda of what do we need to see and why do we need to see it around actually what are we seeing?
It kind of becomes that you know, I talk about this a lot. It's that educational lens, isn't it? It's always, you know, we want to see an outcome. We've got so hung up about seeing an outcome and actually not seeing the child, you know.
That's, again, I think I wrote about that in my conclusion or my summary of what I'd seen.
Yeah,
was that the lenses that we're using now definitely almost demand an outcome, therefore we look for an outcome or we manufacture an outcome at times, or we will interpret the situation in relation to an outcome. Oh, well, that could be fitting against that and this might fit against that, when in actual fact the children are heavily invested in the process.
But I think practitioners are very process driven too. And sometimes this is where, you know, we've got to bring the curveball in, haven't we, and try and see take that step back, really. You know, what does reflective practice actually mean? Let's be honest. You know, we kind of talk about it, but do we actually really do it? And, you know, I think it's time for us to... I think your research is timely, and I think it's really, really important that, you know, we stress about what it is that you're talking about, really, that agency.
I was going to say, because it's almost as if it creates a fractured identity for practitioners. And even in the interviews with me, they argued that this is how I see the child and this is what I would like to do in my practice. And this very reflective, wholesome conversation took place. But the agenda that's manufactured in the classroom through what's on the walls, the resources that are there, everything is geared around the outcome.
Yes.
And that then shifts and shapes the practice that takes place, and that is done very unconsciously. It's not something that can be helped. It's very unfortunate. And again, this is where I see practitioners losing their colour.
In the
same way as we press upon children and they lose their colour, practitioners go through the same process. So you end up with a room full of colourless people at times that are just almost milling about like the characters on the Wii, where you see them in a marketplace. And again, it's where's this vibrancy, where's this sense of agency for practitioners and for children?
So how do children emerge with that agency then? You've just talked about, you know, becoming colourless, but how do we become that colour? How do we become colourful for children and for practitioners?
So again, it's about understanding or drawing on the more than human matter as an important facet of who we are. We need these things to emerge and show our identities and show who we are, because we don't just be, we have to become. And it's this process of constantly becoming and changing and shaping who we are that ends up in a becoming colourful state.
Right, okay. This is fascinating stuff, you know, just listening to you, Julie. Even my own brain is like ticking over. So I know people who are going to be listening are going to be going, oh yeah, we can make connections with that, you know. And you know, next time they go and do those activities with the children or they observe the children, I do hope that they take on board some of this, because I'm taking it on board and I'm just finding it so fascinating. And I love that idea of colourful practitioners and, you know, colourfulness of children. I think you call it something called turning to notice.
Yeah, so when you just need to let go of the agenda, you need to observe who the child is and what is being said. That's what I call turning to notice. And what you're wanting to do is turn to notice the colourful elements. So if the child draws on a particular object, a resource, a time, a space, some matter, and emerges in a different way, of being in the world because of this object or this space and time, what does that tell you? And how can you then do that? So an example of a practitioner becoming very colourful for me was they were having the usual welcome song, welcome to the school, today we're going to do, you're sitting on the carpet, as you see in every situation or environment. And then all of a sudden, this little boy just screamed out, do you know what it is? It's disco day. And in that moment, you just saw the eyes of the practitioner light up, and she literally emerged from the chair and frantically started going and grabbing material and streamers, and the children all rose. It was like, it was a frenzy almost in the classroom, and they created a disco there and then.
Oh, wow. That's my type of moment, that is, Julie, I tell you.
But in that moment, they went through shapes, they went through colours, they did counting, they did physical movement, they were doing gross literacy, physical literacy, everything was transpiring in that moment, and it was all without an agenda.
Oh, I bet you that was magical to see.
Oh, it was. And I've got many other examples of, again, this colourfulness that practitioners can really emulate.
I really like that colourful practitioner. I like that. I think there's a book there. So that leads us on to our next question. So what are we going to see from you next? So what's next on the agenda?
Well, in the summary of my findings, I don't know if any of your listeners are familiar with the works of Sean Tan. A colleague of mine gave me some of Sean Tan's illustrated works. And in one of them, there's The Red Leaf in particular, and The Arrival. And in The Arrival, you see this loomingness of something. And the streets get darker, and it's almost as if this city, this place, is being taken over. And that was very much how I seen school readiness. And it was all, and I wrote a short story to conclude my thesis around how school readiness, because it dances between us, it dances within us, it seeps through our TVs, and it filters walls of schools with ethos badges and chartered rights and stickers and everything, and it really starts to inhabit the classroom through the ways in which we construct them. And none of that is done with the child. So in the future, what I'd really like to do, if the school is more than willing, is see how we can construct a classroom from it being empty over the course of an academic year with the input of parents and children.
Yeah.
To see if we can change the power dynamics of a classroom altogether.
And you could do actually a time-lapsed video as well, couldn't you?
Yep.
And really kind of see it happening in the moment.
Yeah, and I'm at the moment trying to draft up some journal articles to try and get my findings out there as well.
I was going to say, so are we likely to see some published work from you? Obviously, you've got your thesis.
Yeah.
But you just talked about journal articles, so we...
Yes, hopefully some journal articles. Yeah, I think I've got an interview planned with Tez as well.
Fab. And what about a book?
Oh, I'd love to write a book.
Yeah, I mean... I think there's something there, Julie, in that colourful practitioner, kind of colourful child, colourful practitioner. I'd love a book on something like that. And I know that many of my listeners would as well. Any publishers out there, you know, contacting Julie.
Yeah.
Because I think I think you're onto something. And I really, I think a book, you know, how you can actually relate it to practice.
Yeah.
Would be so so influential for our earliest practice. It'd be amazing. I mean, we have got to be realistic. Not many practitioners do read journal articles. So,
no, I know.
You know, so I think it's about making sure that your medium and your voice is out there in lots of different ways. But yeah, I'd love to see a book on stuff like that. And the way that you've just explained it has got me really interested in it now. And I'm like, oh my God, I want to go and read. I want to go. So yeah, the more the merrier. So this leads us on to our last question.
Yeah.
And I ask everybody the same question. So if I could grant you three wishes, mm-hmm. what would they be?
Oh, one for everybody to see the child the way in which I do now. Because it has been life-changing for not only every child's relationship that I now have, but especially for me and my daughter. And then obviously to do further research on this so that it does become an influence. The purpose of the research started off as a personal journey, but now it really is about creating an impact for and with children.
Yeah.
So that would be it. And the final wish, to develop a setting, really, I think.
Oh, with that approach, with the approach.
Yeah,
that'd be amazing. Yeah. Well, it would be lovely if a nursery setting or, you know, an earlier setting got in touch maybe and said, you know, we'd like to have a go at applying this approach. That'd be like your dream, wouldn't it, Julie?
Yes, it would. We'd all be walking around like clowns, probably. It's just those little moments where, like, children, like, touch your earring and they're fascinated on them. That means it's important, but we overlook that all of the time.
We just see it as part of what, but we don't actually kind of think about the understanding of why it happens or what, you know. So there you go. So if you're a publisher, there's a book, and if you're an earlier setting, there's an offer for a classroom of the approach. So, well, Julie, can I just say, this has been really, really fascinating. And I'm so glad that you've come along and discussed your research, because it really, really has opened up my eyes in the half an hour of just listening to you.
Well, thank you very, very much for giving me this opportunity to talk about it, because I never get sick of talking about my research, especially children. So thank you. Anybody who is listening, if you want more information or you want to have a dialogue around it, do just get in touch.
Yeah, what I will do, everybody, is I'll when you click on the to listen to the podcast, I'll put Julie's details. So if you do want to contact her and ask more questions, then please do. But Julie, once again, thank you so, so much. And it's been absolute pleasure having you on Team Early Childhood Podcast.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.